Tonight, we're ready to begin in the 34th chapter of Isaiah, and we'd like to, if we have time, cover both the 34th and 35th chapters of Isaiah, because these two chapters go together as a unit, and they also constitute the kind of the dividing line in Isaiah, or we're getting close to the dividing line. We begin a whole new slant on things at about the 40th chapter. But the 34th chapter is telling about God's destruction and the vengeance that he's going to take upon the enemies of Israel. And the 35th chapter is telling about the fruitful times, the benefits that God's people are going to receive, and in particular would it apply to the return from Babylon, and more especially even to the coming and the time of the Messiah. Now these two chapters are significant in several ways because they kind of climax the theme of the whole book up to this point. We've seen up to this point God destroying the enemies of Israel and then giving them blessings. Over and over and over again, we've seen that pattern repeated. And so these two chapters are kind of the grand climax of all of these works of God in regards to destroying the enemies of his people and then giving them the blessings. I'd like to read a little paragraph here from Barnes's commentary. The general strain of his prophecies thus far has been that however numerous and mighty were the enemies of the Jews, the people of God would be delivered from them all. Such was the case in regard to the allied armies of Syria and Samaria, chapters 7 and 8, of the Assyrian, chapter 10, of Babylon, chapters 13 and 14, of Moab, chapters 15 and 16, of Damascus and Ethiopia, chapters 17 and 18, of Egypt, chapter 19 and 20, and more particularly of the Assyrians under Sennacherib, chapters 25, 29, and 33. The prophecy before us I regard as a kind of summing up or recapitulation of all that he had delivered, and the general idea is that the people of God would be delivered from all their foes, and that happier times under the Messiah would succeed all their calamities. This he had expressed often in the particular prophecies. Here he expresses it in a summary and condensed manner. So we have the stage kind of set now as to how he is going to be dealing in these next two chapters. First chapter now is in regards to God's enemies. So it begins in the first verse of chapter 34. Come near, ye nations, to hear, and hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. Now here in this verse, God is announcing his judgment, his vengeance, his destruction of the enemies of his people. So he says, come near ye nations to hear. He's calling all the nations to come and to hear this. And hearken ye people, and let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. So he's not excluding any person from hearing what he's going to do. It seems that as God took punishment on those who were the enemies of his people, that he was very glad for others to know about it. This is not done in a secret or private way. It's done so that the world can see and the world can be convinced that this is God, this is the living God, and he will protect his people. For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. Now that's what it's all about here. That's what he's calling them in to see. The indignation of the Lord, which is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. Now he states this in the prophecy as though it had already happened. And it was such a sure event that he can say it as though it was a past event, although it's a prophecy. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. Now these people, the destruction would be so great, the contempt for them would be so outstanding, that the slain, their slain, shall be cast out. It's as though they wouldn't even be allowed to be buried, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses. They just lay there and rot so that you could smell the decomposing bodies or the carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood. And we have the picture of a mountain here that would have the mighty rushing streams come down off of it. And as we know, these streams that come down from the mountains, they are what erode or wash away the mountains. And in the stories that the scientists tell of some of the great mountains in this country, like the Rocky Mountains, they tell of the streams being the great eroding force of the mountains. Well, here we have a picture then of mountains that are melted or eroded with the blood that has flown down. So the picture is of so much blood that it acts as a stream would in melting or eroding the mountain. So he says the mountains shall be melted with their blood. And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll. Now the host of heaven would be, of course, the heavenly bodies, such as the stars and the moon and so on. And in the Bible, many times this is used to describe the rulers, the prominent leaders of the world and of the worldly powers. Well, when God takes this vengeance upon these prominent nations, and we read in the introduction of many that he'd already described that he took vengeance upon, it would be like all the host of heaven being dissolved. That is, these worldly figures, world figures, these powerful rulers shining forth in the world as stars and as heavenly bodies, they would be dissolved. They'd cease to be. They'd no longer have any power. They'd no longer have any country. They would no longer be recognized as a person of authority. And the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll. Now, a scroll here is a book. In the time of Isaiah, there was a parchment that was rolled up on rollers. And as you read it, you'd unroll one side and roll up the other side to let the parchment pass before you so you could read what was on it. Well, if this was unrolled and spread out, you could see maybe the whole book or the whole parchment, but then when you rolled it up, it would no longer be visible. All you'd have is two rolls, and you wouldn't have the parchment. Well, he says that the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll. That is, these figures, these worldly powers, as they were seated in their place in the heavenly scheme of things, this whole field of heaven would be rolled together like a scroll and cease to be. You suddenly, you look up and where there had been world powers that were so prominent that it looked that they would never be overthrown, you look up and suddenly it's all disappeared. It's rolled together like a scroll. And all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falleth off from the vine and as a fig, and as a falling fig from the fig tree. So he's just simply describing here how they're going to fall, and the fact that they would fall, just like a leaf would fall off of a fig tree. In Revelation 6 and 13, we have a very similar image given, and I'm going to read, if we have time, several images in the book of Revelation that Isaiah had already given. And the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs, when she is shaken of a mighty wind. Showing that this is also a figure used in Revelation to show the falling of these great powers. That's Revelation 6:13. Now in verse 5, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Now that is a very perplexing phrase, my sword shall be bathed in heaven. And what it really means to me is, he just described these rulers and these powers as heavenly bodies. And so my sword shall be bathed in heaven. My sword is going to be bathed with the blood of and with the flesh of these that the world looked upon as heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea and upon the people of my curse to judgment. My sword is going to come down upon Idumea and upon the people of my curse to judgment. Now here we want to take a little aside and make a notation that of all of these nations that he promises destruction to, the one that he singles out here now and stresses and really calls out by name is Idumea. He refers to them as the people of my curse. This nation in particular was to be destroyed and was to have the indignation of the Lord, his fury, his destruction, and his slaughter come upon them. Well, let's look just for a moment at the history of Idumea. Idumea was the name given by the Greeks to the land of Edom, the country which was settled by Esau. The territory which they occupied extended originally from the Dead Sea to the Elamite Gulf of the Red Sea. Their territory, however, they extended considerably by conquest and carried their arms to the east and northeast of Moab and obtained possession of the country of which Bozrah was the chief city. Well, Mr. Barnes goes on and he says that the capital of East Idumea was Bozrah. The capital of South Edom was Petra or Selah, as it's called in 2 Kings 14:7, Jokthiel. Let's look just a little bit more at what he says about this country of Idumea. Now, this country was actually called Edom. The country received its name from Esau, the son of Isaac, and the twin brother of Jacob. He was called Edom, which signifies red, from the color of the red pottage, which he obtained from Jacob by the sale of his birthright. The account of this is found in Genesis 25, verse 30. After his marriage, he removed to Mount Seir and made that his permanent abode, and the country adjacent to it received the name of Edom. Mount Seir had been occupied by a people called Horites, who were displaced by Esau when he took possession of their country and made it his own, Deuteronomy 2:12. The Edomites were at first governed by princes, improperly translated dukes, in Genesis 36:9-31. They were an independent people until the time of David. They seem to have continued under the government of separate princes until the apprehension of foreign invasion compelled them to unite under one leader and to submit themselves to a king. When the children of Israel were passing through the wilderness, as the land of Edom lay between them and Canaan, Moses sent ambassadors to the king of Edom, soliciting the privilege of a peaceful passage through their country, on the ground that they were descended from the same ancestor, and promising that the property of the Edomites should not be injured, and offering to pay for all that they should consume. Numbers 20:14-19. Now let's turn and read that just a minute. This was one of the main reasons, not the only reason, one of the main reasons that God had such a vengeance against Edom. Because when the children of Israel were passing through the land on their way to the promised land, Edom wouldn't let them come through their land. Numbers 20, beginning with the 14th verse. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Thus saith thy brother Israel, thou knowest all the travail that hath befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, and we dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians vexed us and our fathers. And when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice, and sent an angel, and hath brought us forth out of Egypt. And behold, we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of thy border. Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through the fields or through the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the wells. We will go by the king's highway. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy borders. And Edom said unto them, Thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with the sword. And the children of Israel said unto them, We will go by the highway. And if I and my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through on my feet. And he said, Thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. Thus Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border, wherefore Israel turned away from him. We want to remember that passage because that's one of the prime offenses that Edom had committed against Israel, because these really were brothers. The founders of each nation were brothers. Well, we learn, without reading too much here more from Mr. Barnes, we learn that David subdued the Edomites after they had gone over and become a power themselves, and they remained subdued more or less to Israel for centuries after that. Then the next crowning blow came, the next great offense came, and that is when Israel was in danger of being taken into captivity by Babylon. When the Jews were subdued by the Babylonians and carried captive, they seemed to have regarded it as a favorable opportunity to avenge all the injustice which they had suffered from the hands of the Jews. That is, Edom did. They joined the Babylonians in their attempts to subdue Jerusalem and exulted in the fall and ruin of the city. In Psalms 37, verse 7, he says, Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom, in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. And that's R-A-S-E. So they were hollering for the Babylonians to tear down the city of Jerusalem in the time of Israel's distress, or Judah's distress. They seemed to have resolved to take full vengeance for the fact that their nation had been so long subjected by David and his successors, to have cut all such of the Jews as attempted to escape, to have endeavored to level the whole city with the ground, to have rejoiced in the success of the Babylonians, and to have imbrued their hands in the blood of those whom the Chaldeans had left, and were thus held to be guilty of the crime of fratricide by God. Now let's look at a couple of passages of Scripture that show how God charged them with this. In Obadiah, verses 10 through 12 and in verse 18. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and the foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them, that thou shouldest not have looked on that day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Then in verse 18, Obadiah says, And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. They shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken it. Now that's what Obadiah said in Ezekiel 25, 12 through 14. Thus saith the Lord God, because that Edom hath dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, and hath greatly offended and revenged himself upon them, therefore thus saith the Lord God, I will also stretch out mine hand upon Edom, and will cut off man and beast from it, and I will make it desolate from Teman, and they of Dedan shall fall by the sword. Well, those are just some of the prophecies about God's promise to take vengeance and destruction on Idumea or Edom. It was for this especially that they were denounced and threatened by the prophets with heavy judgments and with the utter destruction of the nation. Now this is found in Isaiah. It's found in Jeremiah. It's found in Ezekiel, in Joel, in Amos, in Obadiah, and in Malachi. So God's prophets heavily pronounced and frequently pronounced destruction and doom on the land of Edom. Thus refusing to aid their brethren the Jews and joining with the enemies of the people of God and exalting in their success was the great crime of their history, which was to cut down the divine vengeance and terminate, which was to call down the divine vengeance and terminate in their complete and utter ruin. Now those are words from Mr. Barnes. And he goes on to show how that eventually, centuries later, Edom was completely abolished and no longer exists. Nobody even by that name of an Edomite or an Idumean existed after the time of Christ, or shortly after the time of Christ. And I won't go into that detailed history. So here we are in verse 5, and he names Idumea as being the object of his vengeance, although he is including all these nations that have been against God's people. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams, for the Lord hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. Now, he's describing this as a sacrifice in which you would take the blood of lambs and goats and rams and offer them as a sacrifice. And the sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It's made fat with fatness. That is, the use of this sword and their slaughter has caused the sword to be filled with blood and to be covered with the fat of these animals. And with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys and rams, for the Lord hath a sacrifice in Bozrah, that's one of the capitals of Idumea, and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. Now he mentions here a sacrifice and a great slaughter. And we'd like to mention something in connection with that. The word redeemed means that you have been bought and paid for with something that was given as a ransom for you to be redeemed with. And most of the time in the Old Testament, when there was a redemption, there was also a corresponding sacrifice made. And many of these redemptions of God's people in which he redeemed them, the sacrifice was the nation that had oppressed them. He made a sacrifice. And here he describes this destruction of Idumea as a sacrifice and a great slaughter. But in the case of Christians, our redemption is brought about by the sacrifice made by the Lord himself. He is our sacrifice, and no other nation has to be destroyed or used as a sacrifice for a Christian to be saved or redeemed today. But I want to just notice that the meaning of the word redeemed carries with it, in general, the idea of something that was sacrificed or something that was used there to bring about the redemption. A price that was paid, in other words. So he further describes this in verse 7. And the unicorn shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fatness. Now the word unicorn here probably means an animal like the rhinoceros that had one big horn. The bullocks and the bulls, these are the young and the old bulls, describing the powerful beasts or animals of the field. And of course this is really referring to the powerful lords and rulers and powerful people of the land of Edom. And he says they're going to come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, they're going to be humbled, they're going to be brought down, and their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fatness. Now, it's typical to describe battlefields as being rich with the fertilizer that is obtained from the blood of those who've been slaughtered on the field of battle. And there are even some legend about some of the battlefields where great slaughter has taken place as to how fruitful the crops were after that. Waterloo was an example of that. And so here he's describing this. Their land shall be soaked with blood. and their dust made fat with fatness. So the very ground itself is going to be more fruitful as a result of the death of these people. The blood and the fat of them is soaked into the dust. For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. So it's the time now when the Lord's taking vengeance. It's the time whenever the recompense is going to come for the controversy of Zion. That is, those who've had a conflict or a controversy or a squabble with Zion, the Lord is now come to make recompense to that. Now, he further described this in verse 9. And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch. Now, pitch is a substance that will burn, kind of like coal or kerosene. So this country is going to have the streams turned into pitch, a tar or something that'll burn, and the dust will be turned into brimstone, which is also a substance that burns quite freely. And the land thereof shall become burning pitch. So this country is going to be in such a terrible condition that it's going to be just like, instead of having water in the stream, it's going to be pitch. It's on fire. Instead of having land, well, the dust is going to be like brimstone. And it'll be just everywhere like burning pitch. Now, we have some similar descriptions to this in Jeremiah 49. Jeremiah talks about the destruction of Idumea, and let's look at some of the terms that he uses. Jeremiah 49:17-18. And Edom, that's the country we're speaking of, Edom shall be a desolation. Everyone that goeth by it shall be astonished, and shall hiss at all the plagues thereof, as in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the neighbor cities thereof, saith the Lord, no man shall abide there, neither shall a son of man dwell in it. So it's just like in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah. And, of course, that was with this brimstone. Again, we have Revelation 14, verse 11, another picture that is depicting torment that God gives to the enemies of God. And he said, and this is really talking about the destruction of Babylon here now. And Babylon in this day and age is, of course, the Catholic Church. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever. And they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast in his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. So he's talking about the smoke of their torment ascending up forever and ever. And it's a figure very closely related to what Isaiah is saying about the destruction of Edom. So he says in verse 10, it shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. In 2 Samuel 22:26-27, with the merciful, thou wilt show thyself merciful, and with the upright man, thou wilt show thyself upright. With the pure, thou wilt show thyself pure, and with the froward, thou wilt show thyself unsavory. Now, this is a passage about God's dealing with man. He's going to be merciful to the merciful. He's going to be upright to the upright. He's going to be pure to the pure. But with the froward, he says, thou wilt show thyself unsavory. So this is an explanation of how God functions. He acts the same way toward people as people act toward him. Pure, he'll be pure. Merciful, he'll be merciful. But froward, he'll be unsavory. So this is a very close description of the destruction of the Babylonian church, which is Catholicism. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever.